And welcome to Dialogue. My name is Victor Agreta, and I am joined today with four panelists. We've got a full house today. I'm joined with Joy Bice with the Department of Children's Services, right? Allison Douglas with Harmony Family Center, Darren Fink with Transfiguring Adoption, and Serenity Andrews with OmniVision. Thank you all for being here. And what we're going to do is we're going to be talking about foster care today. So I want to start off with just getting some of the groundwork out there. First of all, about how many kids in Tennessee are in foster care?
I've got the numbers for the Knoxville. My name's Joy Bice. I'm here
Knoxville. That works.
Knoxville, yeah. Knox region. There's 790 children currently in foster care.
Okay. So what's the current need in the Knoxville area for foster parents?
Well, we need foster parents. You can be anything. You can be single. You can be married, gay, straight. We don't care. As long as you are financially able to meet your own needs, you can be an experienced parent or not. We need you to be in sufficiently good health to take care of kids, and anyone 21 years and older that can pass a criminal history.
Excellent. Explain a little bit about the process of becoming a foster parent.
Their PATH classes, we call them PATH, Parent as Tender Healers. Allison Douglas, who's here with us, is an experienced teacher of those classes. They provide information about how to parent children who've experienced trauma, as well as understanding the system and understanding what the Department of Children's Services can and can't do, because there's a lot of misunderstandings about our power and lack of power. So those are really helpful for understanding that. Understanding how to advocate for the children in your home and what your responsibilities are as foster parents.
Okay. Now, Tennessee in the 1990s had a bit of a reputation as having one of the worst foster systems out there, and there was a lawsuit that came in 2001. It just was recently settled.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about why that was settled and the progress that was made.
The caseloads were dropped for those supervising the children and their families trying to work towards reunification. There were a lot of resources put into place to help reunification happen whenever possible and to support foster families. There's a lot of resources in place to help children stay in the home rather than coming into foster care. There was a lot of medical care was taken better care of. A lot of resources went into that, and we have overcome all of those requirements and been released from the Brian A. lawsuit.
Excellent. The Annie E. Casey Foundation reported that in 2015, Tennessee's reduced the number of children living in non-family state custody settings to 17%. The percentage remains above the national average of 14%, but what does the number mean? What exactly does that 17% mean?
Those are children who are abused or neglected or have experienced severe abuse. Often they come from families who are dealing with mental health issues or substance abuse or a combination of those that prevent the parents or other adults in the home from being able to care properly and ensure the safety of the children in their home. So those are the children that come into foster care. And like I said, we make efforts whenever possible to prevent children from coming into foster care by providing resources, linkage to community resources, and services to prevent that from happening. When it can't happen, we bring the children into foster care. That is through court order, through juvenile court. And we work closely with the juvenile court system to try to get those children home or placed with family whenever possible.
Serenity, I want to talk to you for a minute. What does OmniVision do?
So OmniVisions, we are a private provider agency contracted by the state to provide homes for these children. So one of the things that we are working hard on right now is to look at all of our children that we do have in facilities, those 17% that are not in homes, and trying to find homes for them.
Okay. Let's see, Darren, talk a little bit about Transfiguring Adoption. I was interested in what you guys do because it seems like when you become a foster parent, I mean, I know that you have classes and there's a lot of preparedness, but there's still a lot of other stuff. It reminded me when I was reading about it of when I was a first-time parent and I went home And it's like you leave the hospital and the safe confines, and then all of a sudden you're like dropped into it. And that's when reality hits. And so talk a little bit about what you guys do.
Wow, that's a really good analogy, actually. A good word picture. So Transfiguring Adoption, our tagline is, we nurture growth and foster in adoptive children by giving a hoot about their caregivers. So what we do is we create resources, programs, anything that we can do to really help the caregivers that are in those kids' lives. Because when you're on an airplane, another word picture for you is that they tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before you're helping the child, because you're not going to be able to help that child when there's an emergency if you can't take care of yourself and you're fumbling around. So we really believe strongly that a lot of the caregivers that are coming to the agencies, that they're great caregivers, and we just need to give them the resources and tools they need so that we can retain them and just help and love on kids more and make sure that they're more successful.
And then, Allison, you were a foster parent. What's your status right now?
I am an adoptive parent now. I have 4 children that I adopted from state's custody. And I also work in the field. I'm a parent educator for Harmony Family Center. And so I work with families after they have adopted and while they're in the process of adopting children who weren't able to reunite with their families, and teach them about best practices in parenting, what happens to kids when they are abused or neglected. Because just because a child is placed into a home where their needs are met, it doesn't mean that their past doesn't still affect them. And so what I do at Harmony is create this sense of community with parents and give them the education that they need to help their children to grow in ways that lead them to have really successful lives after abuse and neglect.
And the system seems to be better designed for positive outcomes and long-term placement with families. How is that working today? I mean, anyone can answer that one.
I'm on the foster parent support team, but my specialty is kinship foster care. So we work with families to try to stay together and support extended family members or people who've had a significant relationship with a child to be able to step up and take care of that child within the foster care system. So there's that option. And then we look at traditional foster parents who receive the same education as our kinship foster parents to try to ensure that they have all the tools they need to meet these children. And we're understanding so much more now about trauma and how that molds the brain and how that molds behavior and tools that we can put in place to help children be successful, and putting less shame on negative behaviors and more focusing on what can you do to change that in the future.
It sounds like one of the challenges is that if you are going to foster, then you have to have some concept anyway of a tool set, right? And it's not like you have to be a child psychologist, but you have to implement some of the tools that they would use, right, in counseling with children.
It's completely different discipline for children in foster care. Even children who, even if you were taking a very young child, it's a very different discipline method. And so we try to teach people that, and our foster parent support team works with our families who, as they come up with things that they're experiencing, to be a support to them and provide different options for discipline, different options for support in the community. We also encourage play therapy for a lot of children who it's appropriate for. And not in every case, but in a lot of times it's very appropriate for our younger children. And work with that therapist very carefully on discipline methods and other support systems that we can put in place for children.
I think one of the reasons that Tennessee has become so much more successful after the Brian A. lawsuit is because although it took the lawsuit to bring these deficits to light, we were able to meet the deficits in ways that really keep families together. So we were meeting the needs of children, not just their health needs, but their mental health needs. Mm-hmm. And when children's health and mental health and behavioral health are doing well, then families can do well. And so we were able to much better meet the needs of children by giving them the adults that they needed, whether they're therapists, whether it's a caseworker who moves from having a caseload of many, many children to a more manageable caseload. Tennessee really did step up to the plate in many ways, not just the Department of Children's Services, but things like the Commission for Children and Youth have stepped up to the plate and began doing things like putting into place our Adverse Childhood Experiences training, or the ACEs training, and really bringing that to folks who are in these kids' worlds. So children in foster care don't just have foster parents. They have teachers, they have youth ministers, they have extended family members. Their birth parents need to know this. The idea is kids do best in their birth homes, and then when that is an unsafe place, then we'll move to a foster home or to a kinship placement. And so Tennessee is really meeting the needs of kids, not just while they're in care, but helping them to get back to their family of origin and then allowing folks in the community to help them in better ways.
And it sounds like, you know, a big part of this then is a safety net in the truest sense of the word. It's a web of interconnected, you know, groups. You were talking about ministers. You were talking about not just foster families, mm-hmm. but also the birth families as well. So mm-hmm. all of these people, at what level are they coordinating? Is that done by the state or is that done sort of ad hoc?
Well, one part of the case management that happens when children are in foster care are child and family team meetings. And they take place at least on a quarterly basis. Often it's more often or an as-needed basis where the whole team is making decisions. And the parents' rights are being respected whenever possible regarding education, regarding medication management. If children need to be on any medication, we want to engage them in that discussion. Resources, medical appointments, we want to keep them educated and informed. And so the whole team is making that decision. Guardian ad litem, parents, attorneys, therapists, teachers are often included. Those sorts of resources are all come together for meetings on a regular basis to discuss issues.
And I think one thing I appreciate, too, from the PATH trainings that we receive, as I'm also a foster and adoptive parent, and when we go through our PATH training classes, one thing that's really nice, too, is they really encourage and work with foster parents to create that interweb, that mm-hmm. safety net, that community, so you kind of know how to be an advocate for yourself and go out to the community and talk to youth ministers or talk to the teachers, and what can you tell the teachers, and what's the best mm-hmm. way to advocate for your child that you have in your home, so that other people are included in your world that can help you and you're not alone on an island.
That's excellent. In just a minute, we're going to take your calls. I believe we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute. And we're looking forward to your calls, 865-974-5050. All right, that number to call is 974-5050 or 865-974-5050. You can also tweet at us at WUOTFM or hit us up on our Facebook page. We've got a post on there right now, and if you post a question on there, I will try to get to that. Doesn't look like we have any questions on Twitter or Facebook right now, so I do want to ask this. How has the opioid crisis affected the foster care system? I mean, it seems to me that causes a bigger problem.
It significantly brings the number of children, increases the number of children brought into foster care, whether that is through someone making a report or children being born, and then not only they have to come in because they are exposed to opiates in utero, but then they bring a sibling group with them. It affects our ability to place them with other family members because sometimes those family members are so exhausted by the parents' behavior that they don't want to reconnect there. And so that the biological parents there, their support networks have fallen away, and it's more difficult to rebuild the unit. Not to mention, most of those cases are what we call severe abuse, which means instead of being a slight incline to reunify, it's a very steep hill on what the parents have to accomplish in order to reunify with their children. And beating addiction is just terrible. And I've seen some people that were wonderful parents until they got a prescription from a doctor and became addicted and are now heroin addicts and can't foster their children or can't care for their children and meet their children's needs in a safe way because they can't even recognize that they're not meeting their own needs in a safe way. And when that happens, we have a lot of children in custody. It has significantly increased the number of children we have in foster care, which means that we need more foster homes that are not only willing to foster, but also, if the need arises, to provide permanency. And adoption is what we refer to as permanency often in the department.
And my understanding is that, you know, like you were talking about, Allison, you were a foster parent, then you adopted. And that sort of moves you out of, you know, that column, right? So how does this happen? I mean, do you just kind of hope that as people move out, then more people move in? And, you know, you must have peaks and valleys. I mean, how do you sort of keep that cycle going? How do you keep the supply fresh?
My husband and I came to foster care simply to foster. We really had the idea that we were going to foster for 10 years, and then we were going to go ahead and travel the world and do all those fun things that you do after you have worked. And the first child that we were placed with ended up staying with us. And so we then accepted another child who was related to the first one. We continued to accept children until we really were full. And so four of the children that we fostered ended up staying with us and are now our children and our family. But we just continued to take children while we had that support of the department, and until really our home was full. We lived in a two-bedroom home until we added on. So we expanded in order to continue to parent. But one of the things that does happen is when families become full, we really have a lack of parents to take care of new children who come into the system. And so folks like DCS do lots of recruitment activities. I know that Serenity does lots of recruitment in her agency. And at Harmony, we hope that all of our activities in the community act as a form of recruitment to say that you can do this, that kids need you. And honestly, the kids need us, but we also need them in our lives. Mm-hmm. These children are amazing kids, and the families are amazing too. And so when you're connected with a foster child, you may meet and become closely connected with their family of origin, which is just great for the children, but also great for us as individuals and just as human beings.
Is that a common story that you say, hey, do foster parents say, hey, I'm going to do this for a little while and then I'm out?
I do have quite a few of those, and most of them end up in Allison's boat. A community you become a part of that in the past has kind of separated you from other communities because you had to be, confidentiality becomes kind of a wall. But other foster parents become very close with other foster parents and call on each other when they need each other for a break, what we call respite, to have a couple's weekend and get away and reconnect with one another so that you can use your oxygen mask and take care of each other. There's a real community there, and sometimes it's really hard to leave that, but then you realize your home is full, and so you find other ways to connect. Stay connected with that foster community after you've adopted and closed your home by doing things like mentoring other foster parents, by there's community resources like Transfiguring Adoptions, which provides, you know, those adopted children who still have trauma and are exposed to media. Well, several movies that have come out have been real triggers for kids, and you take them and then there's a meltdown. Well, then we've got Transfiguring Adoption, who has a whole resource guide where they can look up and see if a movie or a book might be a trigger for a child. So that's helpful. There's other communities that Be a Blessing. They put together blessing bags for kids who are coming into foster care that have all sorts of resources, toiletries, blankets, all those things that are needed at the immediate time of placement. Matthew 19:14 Ministries also has a clothing closet and resources, baby beds, toddler beds, all those things. They're really supportive of one another. I know that I called one time and we had, within 24 hours, we had several beds, dressers, everything set up for kids. And I knew that, no, they do that on a regular basis. And, you know, so they need help with that. Whether it's providing the space for those resources, whether it is being someone that transports furniture, or is, you know, if your neighbor is fostering, being the one that they can call and say, hey, I'm getting a placement. It's 7 o'clock. They're going to be here at 7:30 and I have nothing that I need. Being the person that goes and buys the diapers or goes and buys the size 3 clothes for a child, or knows what teenagers like and are willing to go get those things and those snacks and resources for. Those are the people that stay connected and become that web of support.
So here's a question then. You mentioned baby beds, and it made me think about this. What special challenges or difficulties do older children in the foster care system face, and what kind of help exists for them?
The older a child gets, the more likely they are going to not be placed close to home. And our goal is to keep children within their community of origin so they continue those supports. And those familiar faces and those friends who have parents that are appropriate, that they want to go spend the night and have those healthy relationships with, we want to keep them in that connection and support. But the older a child is, the more likely they are to have to go within a provider agency such as Omni, and there's several other provider agencies in the community, and they are more likely to have to be placed outside of region as far as Memphis. We don't want that to happen. We want children staying in a familiar setting. It reduces trauma. It keeps them connected. And we're more likely to see what issues are arising so within that unit so we can help fix them and make them successful upon exiting custody.
Yeah. At OmniVisions, we do specialize in placing older children. And it can be a task because a lot of people are biased against older children simply because of their age. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of families who are intimidated by an age, a lot of our families that we recruit start out as respite families. And they may just do it a weekend here, a weekend there. And they end up falling in love with these kids mm-hmm. and taking them on as a permanent placement because come to find out, 16-year-olds need love too. And they have a lot of love to give as well.
And that was a question I was going to ask was, is one of the barriers to this fear? Are people
yes.
afraid of becoming foster
Absolutely.
Parents?
Absolutely.
I think it's the fear of the unknown, too, because I think all of us have the kind of the responsibility of sharing with the public and getting the word out and letting people educated on people on it. I know we got a message in Transfiguring Adoption on Facebook this week, someone wanting to know how do they go about adopting. It's just this foreign concept where people want to do it, people want to get involved, but they don't know how it works. And then they hear the horror stories through media or different avenues. And I think it puts them off because they just don't understand what it all entails. And we're scared. Human beings are scared of the unknown and what we don't understand. And it can be a scary place. And I think people just need to be educated on what's going on.
Absolutely. And along with that, you have the people who are intimidated, but you also have the people who think that older children just don't need parents as much as younger children. And that's absolutely false, because who is going to help that teenager navigate college? Who's going to walk that young woman down the aisle when she's getting married? Who's going to be there for their first children? Who's going to be the grandparents? So older children are absolutely in need of parents, no matter their age.
And I'll say from experience, Trinity, from experience with older kids in my home, they also, this is more real to them. They understand what's going on in their mm-hmm. life. They understand that if they're approaching 18 and there's not, it doesn't look like there's an adoptive home set up for them. They're aging out of the system. They just get what's going on a lot more. And so I think some of their fears and some of their things are a lot more real. And that's all the more reason why they need someone to step up to the plate for them and say, yeah, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to be stability for you. They need that probably, I don't say more than younger kids, but it's just more real to them.
We actually have a question on Facebook from Chad in Sevierville. He's asking where he can find more information. And
please call 877-DCS-KIDS, and that is a place where you can get some information. Also, we have a website. If you go on the tn.gov website and just put foster care in or becoming a foster parent, it'll lead you to the right page. And there's all sorts of information there, and there's an online application to complete. There's also the provider agencies such as Camelot, Child Help, Florence Crittenden, Helen Ross McNabb, Holston Home for Children, OmniVisions, Smoky Mountain Children's Home and Youth Villages. You could call any of them, and they would be glad to set you up with the process and help you through.
Or you can go on the Omni Visions website, which is theomnifamily.com.
Excuse me. And just as a reminder to those who are listening, you're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. You can also call us right now at 865-974-5050, or you can tweet at us at WUOTFM, and we look forward to your calls. I was curious, what's it really like being a foster parent?
It's really challenging, and it's really wonderful. I think like everything in life, the hardest things are the best things. And so, yes, it's really scary to get a phone call when you're walking around in Belk doing some shopping one day. This is my personal experience. And 25 minutes later, there's a little boy in your living room who is 2 years old, can't speak, is unable to tell us what is wrong, but is really, really terrified and scared. And now I'm his primary caregiver. And so that is really frightening. It's also really doable because we do have support. We have peer support. We have support from our agencies in the state. But it's really a great experience to watch these kids grow, to see the changes that they make. And for me, one of the best experiences is connecting that child with their birth family and just really being a facilitator in family healing. My idea of life was certainly not to have four children. My husband and I were child-free for 12 years before we began taking in kids as foster family. And so we didn't do it to adopt. We really wanted to work with families. But we know that sometimes, especially in cases of addiction, the length of time that it takes a family to heal is not healthy for the child to be separated. They do need that permanent family. And so I feel very lucky that I've made connections with many of my children's birth parents, and that they're part of their life. My middle son spends birthdays and holidays with his birth mother and birth siblings, and I really feel like they're part of our family. And so the goal would always be, as a foster parent, to see these children return home and to see our community thriving. Just because a child is adopted, it only solves part of the equation, because there is still someone in the community who's suffering, who has not gotten their life together. And so we want to bring the whole family together to be healed and whole. But when we can't do that, many of us as foster parents are happy to have these children be permanently part of our lives.
And Darren?
Yeah, I'm going to totally agree with Allison, because it's challenging, but it's very rewarding at the same time. One thing I really admire with just meeting other foster parents as a foster dad in the area, and then through transfiguring adoption nationwide, is I meet so many people that the good foster parents look at this child and say, hey, there's an injustice here. There's something not right. And they don't back down from that, and they won't stand for that. And they wake up every morning with the tough issues, with tough things going on in that child's world, in their world, that they weren't expecting. But they continue to go every day and say, but something's not right, and I'm going to make sure it is right, or I'm going to continue to try to heal what's been broken.
Fostering is definitely equally laughter and tears, because it's really challenging, but it's also such a growth experience for families.
So what are some of the most important things for people to know, for anyone who might be listening, if they're considering becoming a foster?
When you're fostering, you're planting seeds, picking fruits way on down the road, and that our children may have they may have gone further in their journey, but their road has got a lot of potholes. And so some of those potholes are things that people learn when they're 2 and 3 years old, but the child's 16. So you go back and you fill in that pothole together and you smooth it over and you don't shame about it. And then you move on until you hit the next one, and then you go, oh, wow, we just hit a pothole. Let's fix that together. And then you do it together. And that 16-year-old may know things that you're like, oh my goodness, how does a child that age know how to do those things for themselves? Sometimes the skills they have are not the most appropriate, and we have to redirect that into healthy methods of self-care. But you find things that you're so impressed with how far they've come, and you look back in a week, in a month, in a year, in 3 years, and you go, oh my goodness, this is not the same child that came through my door carried by a worker or screaming and crying. And you see that that child didn't do it on their own, that you helped mold that and guide that, and you know that the fruit's coming.
On that note, we're going to take another quick break, and you can, of course, join us in the call. It's 974-5050. We'll be back in just a minute. And you're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. Thanks for listening. The number to call is 865-974-5050 if you'd like to ask any questions of our panel. You can also tweet at us at WUOTFM. And we want to come back and talk about opioids. And first of all, I'm curious, exclusive of drug abuse, what are some of the main reasons children end up in the foster care system?
Abuse and neglect. It could be that the parent has mental health issues and just simply cannot recognize the child's needs and meet those. Sometimes this is generational trauma, and they have not learned the skills to take care of the children because they weren't taken care of in that way. And now our society is more aware of how that affects people long term, and we act sooner. Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of calls coming in, actually, questions anyway. The first one is, what would be an example of a movie or book that would trigger something's wrong? Let me bring Carol in here. Hi, Carol. Are you you on the phone?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you were asking, what's an example of a movie or book that could trigger something, right?
Right. She mentioned that, and I just wasn't sure how that would work.
So with Transfiguring Adoption, we have a sister group called Adoption at the Movies. It's out of California, and we actually have a licensed clinical social worker that he will go to the movie premieres, and he'll take a look at things and talk about how they're going might trigger families. One that sticks in my head is Pete's Dragon. I know that's not a real current movie, but the remake of Pete's Dragon, in the very beginning of the film, if you remember or have seen it, Pete loses his family. And it's kind of, for a Disney movie, it's kind of horrific, and it's very real. And since a lot of our kids have all been taken from their birth families, that can be triggering for them. It just reminds them where their situation is at and what's going on with them. I know Allison had. Do you remember one of the ones that you talked about?
There are so many movies where kids lose their parents. And for those of us who grew up in a family where our parents were nurturing and with us, we just think of that as kind of a trope in kids' films. But for my children, when they see a movie where a mom disappears or dies, that can bring up a lot of fear and anxiety. And I've had to leave many, many movies because one of my children is having a little bit of a panic attack because of how raw that is for them.
Triggers panic attacks or crying or
all of the above.
All of the above. Okay.
I will have to say too, Carol, I've even had movies like The Great Gilly Hopkins, something that you think would be great to show your kiddo. And some kids it is. You just have to know your child and what they can handle, what they can talk about, but for one of my kiddos, they were watching The Great Gilly Hopkins, which she is a foster kiddo. And they halfway through the movie, they said, "Are you kidding me? Why are we watching this awful thing?" And they actually had questions and different things later on that led me to believe, yeah, maybe we shouldn't watch this.
Wow.
Or preview it and then use it as a learning opportunity later. I think we can all learn from those things that trigger us and bring up bad memories. It's a good way to move forward.
Yeah.
And I'll put a plug in for Transfiguring Adoption, too. The movies and the books that we have listed on our website all have discussion guides. So if you decide to watch a movie or read a book with your child, we have discussion questions. We know people can't think always on the spot So you can go through with your child discussion questions after you go through media.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Great question, Carol. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And we have another question from Danielle here. Danielle, you're on.
Hi. I'm actually a foster parent in Knox County, and I just kind of had a comment to make. One of the questions that I get asked the most is, how could you possibly take a child into your home when you know that there's a good chance that they'll leave? And I just wanted to say that's kind of what I struggled with the most when my husband and I were trying to decide if we were ready to be foster parents. So you do kind of have to ask yourself that question, and you're never really fully prepared. But honestly, I look at it as I would rather take on that hurt when they leave, or anything that they're feeling, than let them feel that by having a bad experience or to not have a loving home to go to. So I just feel like that's kind of a common thread that people think, oh, I could just never do that. And you can. I mean, a lot of times, too, like Allison was saying, you make a bond with the birth family. And, you know, even if they do go home or with a family member, a lot of times they still, like a lot of our kids, we still see them even though they've gone home or with a family member because we've made that bond. So that makes it a little bit easier, too, because they're not completely out of your life. And that's not like that in every situation, but there's a chance for that if you all work together. And I think that's made it a little bit easier for me as well. So just because that's a question I get asked a lot, I just wanted to make that comment.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Thanks for doing that, too. Thanks for being vulnerable.
Yes.
Our kids, a lot of our kids, they might not have had that experience where they feel that love and that connection with someone. And I do hear that a lot, that people are scared to get attached and then watch the child go back to the birth family. But they need that. They need that modeling. They need to have those good relationships and see how to make them. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
If
you're feeling that fear, I mean, how much more are these kids feeling that?
Yeah. Right.
And that's something that people in the community can support our foster families through when a child reunifies, helping them, supporting them in caring for themselves and healing through what truly does feel like a loss. Hopefully our foster parents have self-care skills and have the ability to rebound and to take care of themselves when that happens, that our children in foster care simply don't have. And so thank you, Danielle, for being willing to take on that pain, that potential pain, so that a child is less likely to experience it.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, we wanted to get back to something here on the opioid crisis. And we asked, of course, about, you know, factors outside of that. But, you know, can DCS do anything to curb some of those factors? I mean, is that realistic? This is obviously a huge problem. I mean, it's become a national epidemic, as people have discussed just this week, as a matter of fact.
As the resources become more and more available for treatment, I think I'm seeing a few successes. They are few and far between because of how heroin has become another issue again. I believe Allison can probably talk to more what that looks like for children long term, but it's a draining expense on our economy, and yes, it's going to affect, even if you have a normal healthy child within the classroom situation, it's going to impact your child, and so you need to be aware.
Well, and it can affect not just mentally but physically the children, right? We were talking about NAS. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. NAS is neonatal abstinence syndrome, and NAS is only one part of prenatal drug exposure. NAS is when the child is actually physically dependent upon the drug, and when they're cut off from that supply, they have physical symptoms like tremors, difficulty with GI issues. They have a very distinctive cry because they're in pain. They're withdrawing from the opiate. But really, that's just one small part of what happens to these children, because after they are released from the hospital, they often physically appear to be doing fine, but they have other issues because of the way that the drugs enter the fetus during its development of its central nervous system. And so while there are not a huge amount of peer-reviewed studies currently, I collect these like baseball cards in my work. Mm-hmm. There is enough information out there to say that most of these children have ongoing challenges. It may not be the same for every child because there is so much variability. So it depends on when the mother was using, how much they were using, during what point of development, what the genetic load that mom was carrying to begin with is. And so many, many children with NAS have challenges throughout their life. Three of my four children have exposure issues, and they all have different challenges, but they are challenges nonetheless. And so in school, they often have problems. There's lots of what we call sensory problems, meaning the way they process the senses gets a little scrambled as their brain interprets it. And so things like cold may feel really good to them. One of my kids loves to play in the snow barefoot. And so I'm glad that folks know I'm connected with DCS, or I feel like they might call DCS when they see him playing out in the snow barefoot for a bit. So NAS is a really complicated issue, but we do have a good deal of resources to assist us as parents when we are walking through that, and for our children so that their lives are easier.
Joy, do you have any numbers in terms of, I mean, has this been an uptick in the past 20 years, and you know, how much of the opioid crisis has contributed to foster care?
I've been with the department nearly 11 years, and I would say in the past 6 years, I have, and I'm just ballparking it, but I would say in the past 6 years, I've seen this significant increase. I do really appreciate the doctor at UT who's making efforts to take mothers off of drugs and detox them during pregnancy to decrease the likelihood of having a child born with NAS. I do appreciate that there are, it's becoming a more talked about subject, and that we're understanding sensory issues. And I have so many people saying my child has sensory issues that were never drug exposed. It's becoming more of a topic that we discuss, and we're talking about it being a way to teach children so that they meet developmental milestones in a way that is part of the general topic of community and education. And I do appreciate that. So, yes, we've seen a significant increase. I would say out of the families, the kinship families that I work with, the large majority have NAS children in their home. So when a child gets hungry, they're less tolerant of the time to heat a bottle, and they draw up and they're doing, they're screaming while they're trying to get the bottle warmed up. So we talk about just those soothing techniques. They may want to stay more tightly bundled than you would normally think a child with swaddling. They may need swings that have multiple different motions to keep them soothed. And then, like I said, those children have older siblings that also come in at the same time. So it may be that grandparents, and I have a lot of great grandparents who have their great-grandchildren, great-aunts and uncles who have their great-niece and nephews, and they all of a sudden are raising four more children when they thought they were long done. So all of those, if you see that happening, step up and say, what can I do? Can I bring you dinner? You know, I know that Mr. Fink's group has had drives for night lights and paper plates. Do you know how wonderful it is to have to not do paper plates when you've got a new child in your home? And to be just that support that says, hey, I'm going to watch for those drives that are going down. I'm going to put those blessing bags together, and I'm going to make sure that the families in our community that are taking these children in, if I can't be a foster, I'm going to foster parents.
Speaking of which, we got another call. This is Marjorie in Oak Ridge. Marjorie, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to call. I'm a licensed counselor. I'm also a former foster care case manager. But I have worked a lot with both children in foster care, and I'm also with birth parents that are working to get their children back. And sometimes they're not aware, really, of their rights to participate, like to attend school meetings or doctor office visits, and I often tell them, well, you know, you should talk to the case manager because I believe, you know, you should have that right. And I think sometimes they're not informed, and I just want to know. I know that's the policy that they, you know, should, you know, they want to let them know, but I think they're not always informed.
I think when I went through PATH classes, and also I was also a foster parent in Illinois, I remember going through the classes and there was so much information. I was drinking from a fire hydrant, and I can remember being very concerned about, and I've been to other Q&As with other things in Illinois and different places on the other side of the training. And everyone's concerned about the emergency room visits. Like, what paperwork do you fill out? Because I think people are worried. And I remember as a foster parent being concerned about that. But on this side of the fence, I'm like, the doctor's going to take care of the kid. Like, they're going to make sure the kid leaves the emergency room without paperwork or anything. I think those things are, as a matter of fact, they are talked about, what rights we have in the trainings. But I would have never remembered them because I had so much information given to me. And that's why I think it's important for them to recontact their caseworker. Their caseworker will get back with them. Our caseworkers have been great telling us what our rights are and what we can do and go forward as situations arise.
I believe she was talking about birth families.
Families. I'm sorry.
We have child and family team meetings, and we do ask those birth families to come to the table, and they have what we call a roadmap towards reunification. It's a permanency plan. It becomes a court order.
Right.
And that states who they can contact for what services, who their worker is, what, you know, we do want their input. It's very important. It's vital. They have all the child's history in their memory banks, and we have nothing. So their input is vitally important. And we do ask them and encourage them to come to doctor's appointments. Some families require supervised visitation and supervised contact, so the case manager may have to be present in order for them to attend various appointments. Their input in education is so vitally important, and we want to do that in a very respectful manner where we are not shaming them and we are supporting them towards doing what they need to do for their child for reunification to happen. And I've had so many foster parents who are so excellent at that and are so graceful at stepping back, and when the doctor looks at them to ask a question, simply turning to the birth parent and saying, what can you tell us about that? And that is something that is so gracious and wonderful about a lot of our foster parents. But I think it takes experience and overcoming that fear of birth families and having the wherewithal to take the first step towards connection. And that's what we're here for. That's the whole purpose of our existence, is to connect with one another. And so being able to take that first step is sometimes scary, but realizing you're not just fostering children, you're fostering families.
I frankly think that there's so much more fear in foster parents surrounding interaction with birth families than there is with really doing the work of foster parenting. And so as a parent trainer, I always want families to understand that the child's primary connection is with their birth family or who they were living with before you. And I think a lot of times, and I think this may be part of your point, is that there's a lot of celebrating and cheers for us as foster families. But the truth is, those birth families are facing a devastating loss. No matter what type of mistake this mother or father may have made, the loss of a child is an incredible trauma. Mm-hmm. And so we need just as many folks rallying around those birth families as we do rallying around us as foster and adoptive families.
That's true.
So I think that there is a lot that we as a community need to do to step up behind families who are struggling so that their children can return home. That really is what many, many children need. It is what the majority of children need, is to return to a healthy, happy home. And when that's not possible, to be placed in another type of placement.
Marjorie, thanks so much for your call, and I'm going to let you go.
Thank you very much.
And we've got just about another minute or so here, and I want to go around the room, and let's just remind people again, you know, what are the resources that you represent, or how can people get in touch with your group?
I'm Joy Weiss. I'm with Department of Children's Services. I'm in the Knox region. But if you're interested in fostering, please call 877-DCS-KIDS. It's actually 877-237-5437. Or you can go onto the TN.gov website. It's /DCS/article/inquiry form for potential foster parents. And that'll take you in. That will get you in contact with somebody on my team, a foster parent support worker who will give you a few facts, help you get started in the process, help you get started in orientation with PATH to see if this is the right thing for you. And then you can decide from there what you'd like to do. And at any time you may decide, hey, this is not the process for us. We'd rather foster families, then that's fine.
Yes, and I'm Serenity Andrews with OmniVisions, and we are a private provider placement agency, and we are contracted by DCS to place children. We have a highly skilled support team that surrounds our foster families 24/7. So if you are interested in that, you can go to our website, theomnifamilytoday.com, or you can call us at 524-4393.
Excellent.
And I'm Darren Fink. I'm with Transfiguring Adoption. We nurture growth and foster and adoptive families by giving a hoot about their caregivers. You can visit us at www.transfiguringadoption.com. And we actually have some great opportunities for people that can't foster or adopt. They're just not at that place in their life. We're going to be having some drives and different things like that for the rest of the year coming up to help families.
And I'm Allison Douglas. I work for the Adoption Support and Preservation Program at Harmony Family Center. You can visit us at harmonyfamilycenter.org.
And I want to thank everybody who's been with us today. I really, really appreciate this. This is, of course, a hugely important topic, and we're going to keep talking about this throughout the year, of course. And again, thank you all for being here. You're listening to WUOT 91.9 FM. My name is Victor Agreta, and you've been listening to Dialogue. Thanks so much for joining us.